Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith. Hey everybody, Chad Wesley Smith here with another episode of the Jug Life Podcast. Joined as always by the notorious M-A-X, Max Ada. How you doing, buddy?
Doing pretty well. How you doing?
Good, good, good. Today's episode is going to be brought to you by herpes and hack squats. It's a lifestyle. Hopefully one that not too many people are living.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot at 24 Fitness.
You think they got the herpes from the hack squat machine?
Oh, That's why they tell you
to bring a towel. You gotta wipe it down after.
Yeah. If your hoodie doesn't have sleeves, you're exposed. So.
Did you know that there's a hooded sports bra now?
That's amazing.
That's a thing.
So if just your head, just the back of your head's cold, but the rest of your body is really hot.
The world is still not ready for the pending, hopefully perpetually pending launch of the Juggernaut Stringer hoodie. It's the best of all worlds. Maybe a Stringer crop hoodie. And we could really get it going. Just the thinnest material that a hood could potentially attach
it's,
to.
What if it was just a hood? They were just selling
holy
hoods.
Shit. You have just mind revolutionized blown. The industry.
You're going, it's just hood. Just hood. No shirt.
Oh, my God.
But you put it on like a hood. It's, like, connected. So you can't. You got to, like, put it on, and you can take it off and put it on.
This is amazing.
Get me on Shark Tank. Yeah. Call Stan up.
The Cuban on the phone. Yeah. The hood. The shirtless hoodie.
And it's called a hood. And there's the... The E part is gone, so we sell it as hoodie minus E. Hood.
Hood. TM'd. That's TM'd for anyone watching.
Don't let anyone watch this. They might steal that and patent it.
They're going to patent the shit out of that hood. Is it going to be a single seam hood? What kind of hoods are we dealing with here?
It's a zigzag.
Zigzag hood. All right. So today we're going to be answering some of your questions that came in Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, all the places where you can find us. So let's just go ahead and get into it. This first one is a bit of a trio of questions that all kind of touch on the same subject. So Joe's Barbell, Olinate 105. Do you think he competes as a 105?
I hope so.
Maybe.
People be putting their weight class in that Instagram handle, and then they change classes, you're kind of up shit creek after that.
Yeah, you totally lose your brand.
Yep.
And Chris D87. These questions all touch on assessing strength versus technique through lifting ratios, figuring out do I need more strength work, more technique work? And then Ole Nate's question was about training the clean and jerk together or separate. And Max will kind of cover when it would be appropriate within the context of these different answers. So, Max.
And the question is kind of asking, are there strength ratios, a number value associated with four or five different exercises that give you an indicator as to do you need to train strength more? Do you need to train this exercise more, that exercise more? At what point are you to stop working on technique more and work on strength more? So the way that I organize training and I basically follow this process, or what is the process to say somebody is strong enough or somebody needs to become stronger, somebody needs to fix this error in their technique, and do this exercise, instead of using strength ratios and numbers like that.
And a strength ratio would be like clean compared to front squat,
right,
or clean compared to back squat, that type of thing.
Yeah. I look first at how efficient is the lifter, and that baseline level, having a numerical value we can assign to how efficient a lifter is, allows us to say across the board we can look at 10 different lifters of 10 different qualification levels and say, these guys are all this level of efficiency, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the process to find that is going to be, you know, looking at how high they pull the bar relative to how low they can catch the weight. The closer those numbers are, you know, the less energy they're expending, the more weight they can lift. If they're only pulling the bar, if they only need to pull the bar 50% of their height in order to catch it, and they're pulling it 70% of their height in order to catch it, they're less efficient than someone who pulls the bar 52% of their height. Make sense? So once we have an idea of what efficiency is, we can look at, you know, are they efficient? Are they inefficient because of these factors? Do they pull the bar too high, therefore they're strong enough to lift a heavier weight, so do we need to spend more time on technique? Once we kind of determine that, we can say, yeah, this guy needs to spend more time becoming more technically efficient, more technically skilled. We can spend time on that instead of on strength. The other side of the coin is if somebody is really, really efficient, if they're pulling the bar only as high as they need to and they're maximizing their physical abilities, then we can say, okay, it's a matter of getting them stronger. The interim area in between those is that somebody is very decently strong, has decent technique, but makes lots of errors, right? They miss lifts a lot. They're forward, they're back. The trajectory of the barbell is not good. How do we then assign the right exercises to them?
So just to recap for those listening and watching, three main areas he's talking about there. Bar height, the speed under the bar, where the athlete catches the bar, how low they can catch it, and then the trajectory of the bar. Is it in the right place when it goes overhead?
Right. The big one people are mostly working on when they're practicing lifting is going to be controlling trajectory, maximizing the positions of their body to get the most out of their strength, their leverages, et cetera. And that kind of is where I classify the exercises in a way that affects what effect does the exercise have on one of those three things, bar height, trajectory, or speed under the bar.
Where's its greatest effect,
right? So we look at the exercise in a classified sense. Okay, you know, pulls and squats and stuff are going to have a really big impact on the height of the bar. They affect your strength mostly. They affect the power you have. Lifts that are, you know, complex, that are, you know, without a hook grip, without foot movement, without bar contact, are going to affect trajectory of the bar because you're forced into a situation that's much more difficult to control the bar. And to be successful, you have to modify the trajectory or manipulate it so that you're successful in the lift. You know, if you don't use a hook grip, you can't bang the bar super far out with your hips and make the lift and be successful. Obviously, you can train poorly and miss lifts all the time and do the right things, but miss them and you're not going to get anywhere. But that's the same for anything you do. And then the third category is, you know, exercises that have a big impact on the time to fixation, the speed under the bar. Exercises that are grouped in that category are going to emphasize that portion of the lift, you know, from the high hang, from the blocks, et cetera, et cetera. So instead of looking at saying, hey, I do hang snatch with this much, I do block snatch with this much, I front squat this much, I do RDLs with this much, what lifter do I need, what program do I need? We look at how efficient is the lifter, and then what areas do we need to work on? What of those three in the triad, what of those three categories is, you know, the emphasis of this training block? And then we select exercises that affect that, right? And then go from there.
So to add to this question for my own efficacy, what do you think is the most and least trainable of those three qualities?
So the most, I would say the least trainable is going to be, the least trainable is probably going to be speed under the bar, right? It's probably the most determined by your physical proportions, your dynamic flexibility, just the general, you know, your general level of explosiveness. The most trainable is going to be, it's probably even between the trajectory of the barbell and strength, probably more to the strength, to the height of the bar, simply because it's just easier to train to become stronger. Mm-hmm. There's millions of guys in the world, well, thousands of people out there that can probably pull the world record deadlift or the world record snatch high enough to snatch it, as high as the guy who snatched it did, right?
Yeah, to the same percentage of their body height.
Shot putters and stuff. I mean, there's a lot of people out there, but getting under the bar and having the bar be in the right place is a completely different world.
Yeah.
So that's where I would say the trainability is. And then, you know, from a perspective of long-term development for an athlete, you're working in each of those categories in the long term. You know, initially you're working primarily on the least trainable quality, right? Speed under the bar, the trajectory of the barbell, because that's most important initially. Once that's solidified, strength becomes the most important. So as a lifter becomes more advanced, their training shifts to more and more trainable factors because that's all they have left, right?
And speed under the bar, or the ability to fix oneself under the bar, is not just and correct me if I'm wrong, or adjust this answer, is not just a product of explosive qualities. It is a product of technique. It is
right.
It is the athlete's technique putting them in the right place to get under the bar the right way. You know, if we were to take myself and Kane Wilkes,
right,
I am much stronger than he is, and probably, you know, technique also works to bar height, because he can probably pull the bar as high as me,
right?
Not because of strength qualities, but because of the efficiency in his
right.
pulling. But that's a lot of what the technique goes to, is how they're able to fix themselves under
right.
the bar faster.
Every exercise you do, as long as it falls in the continuum of acceptable exercises, you know, on this slice of the spectrum of specificity, they all have an impact on your lifts. And largely, it's a matter of coordination and technique that's going to have the biggest benefit. So, you know, doing a hang snatch doesn't necessarily have a negative impact or have no impact on the trajectory of the barbell. Mm-hmm. It's just that there's a predominantly larger impact on speed under the bar, because while, let's say, you do a hang snatch from really high up, you can still have poor trajectory and make the lift, or you can still be not manipulating the trajectory in the correct way to develop good skill there, right? Whereas, you know, same with like doing a snatch or a muscle snatch, you can develop a trajectory a little bit better, but not have any real significant impact on speed under the weight.
Thank you to Virus International, sponsor of the Jug Life podcast. Visit virusintl.com and use Jug, JUGG, for 10% off your next order. All right, so moving on to the next question. This is from Strongman Stella. Asks, what is the best way to peak for max reps in strongman? So I'll touch on some ideas here that certainly are applicable to strongman. Could also be useful to CrossFit in the right type of events, or if you're training like a football player for the 225 rep test. The first thing you need to establish is the person strong enough to do a necessary amount of reps? You know, there's no way to peak for reps if it's your one rep max. You know, it would be a different discussion. So once we've established that the maximal strength is not the determining factor, and you'll still be developing maximal strength alongside of this, now we're really getting into the capacity for reps and lactic capacity, which that might be. And what I've found to be really useful for this, and I was very successful with in one of my best deadlifting performances ever in a strongman contest, where I did like 20 reps of a 600-pound deadlift in 1 minute, was I used a strategy where in like every other week or every third week, I would pull from descendingly lower and lower blocks. So I took the 600-pound deadlift, and I was, you know, an 800-pound deadlifter at the time. And the first week went from 6-inch blocks, as many reps as I could, 3 sets of 1 minute, as many reps as I can with pretty much full recovery between that, which is a long recovery, like 8 or 9 minutes between the sets, maybe more depending on your fitness level. And then 3 weeks later, I came back to that and went to four-inch block, pulling as many reps as possible from a 4-inch block, trying to match the reps that I achieved on the 6-inch block. And then 3 weeks later, came back to 2-inch block, tried to match the reps that I did from the 4-inch block. And then finally, the competition was next, which was the reps from the floor. That was extremely successful for me. I did more reps from the floor than I did from any of the block heights, and that's adrenaline and accumulated fatigue from all the other training playing into that. But that was a really useful strategy for me. I took that strategy from a 225 rep test strategy taught to me by James Smith of descending board heights for the bench press. So they establish a rep max. And you could do this with 225. We tended to do it with like 60 to 70% of the athlete's max, as we saw that as kind of the sweet spot of this lactic capacity development. So, they'd take 60% of their max and go three sets of max reps off of a two-board press for week one. And then in week two, come back with the same weight off of a one board. And then week three, the same weight off of the chest, trying to match the reps from the shortened range of motion each time. So you might have to be kind of creative in how to apply this to different events. If it's an axle clean and press, maybe you would be getting into like some kind of reverse band situation to allow the athlete to exceed their current capacity. If I only have the capacity to do 20 reps from the chest, doing 20 reps and 20 reps and 20 reps isn't going to give me the capacity to do 30 reps. I need to find some way to allow myself to do 30 reps so my body can learn how to do that. So the way that we did that with the 225 rep test was a board, two boards, three boards. We do 30 reps, then try and match that capacity at the lower one and the lower one. I probably wouldn't advocate for using in like a clean and press for reps using that kind of strategy. I just train with the lighter weight rather than getting too fancy with the reverse band type of setup, because that's gonna probably disrupt technique too much. Another area that I was successful with in a clean and press for reps kind of scenario with the axle was doing more like a cluster set kind of strategy. So 300 pound axle clean and press for reps. If my goal was to do 7 reps in a minute, maybe I do 3 reps, rest 30 seconds, 3 reps, rest 30 seconds, 3 reps. So now I've done 90 or 9 reps in 90 seconds. And then I try and cut those rest periods down or increase the number of reps. So I either go 3 reps, rest 20 seconds, 3 reps, rest 20 seconds, 3 reps, or 4 reps, rest 30 seconds, 4 reps, rest 30 seconds, just as long as the capacity is increasing. So that's the main goal you have to achieve is to exceed your current capacity. Creative ways to do that with some of the lifts, like a shortened range of motion, or in some other ones where you don't want to disrupt the the creative way would disrupt the technique too much. I think cluster sets, rest pause type of bodybuilding kind of rep strategies can be really useful for that. I like this one from Yep Yep It's Teddy. Asked us, was Tony Perkis crazy or just ahead of his time?
Clearly ahead of his time. He's completely, if he walked into a CrossFit gym now, as he did in the end scene, wouldn't even be noticed by most of the members, in my opinion.
If you don't know who Tony Perkis is, I don't know if this is the podcast for you. Tony Perkis is the developer, creator and developer of the Perkis system.
Yeah.
One of the most revolutionary training methods in all of training history.
When I think of top coaches, top innovators in your field, Ivan Abadjiev, Charlie Francis, Tony Perkis.
Yes. Some of the signature components of the Perkis system, smashing ice blocks on your stomach with a sledgehammer,
yep.
Pull-ups from trees that are hanging over the edge of a cliff,
yep.
Those things where you slide side to side, shame.
Shame is a huge factor.
Big part of the Perkis system.
Big dose of shame every day.
Carrying devil logs are very, very critical, a special exercise for the Perkis system. But if you don't know, Tony Perkis is a character from the movie Heavyweights. heavyweights was in a time, a time in the 90s where Disney was just they were succeeding hard. Yeah. Where because it featured 50% of the cast was from
Mighty Ducks.
The Mighty Ducks. We had the captain. Oh, captain is his in
thought.
Heavyweights. Carp was his character.
Yeah.
We have Goldberg. We have Russ, the king of the knuckle puck. I'm sure that there were some others.
Are we maybe missing that Mighty Ducks 1, hockey season ends, Heavyweights is the summertime, they don't say anything.
Heavyweights maybe was a prequel.
Or really. Heavyweights is the prequel?
The kids weren't in good enough shape to play hockey yet.
Or it's maybe it's the end. It's the end of Mighty Ducks trilogy in which the Mighty Ducks have fallen out of shape because they've succeeded so much.
I could see it being more
alternate reality?
An interlude between 2 and 3.
Yeah.
Because they got so high on themselves and they were just eating all the fucking Twinkies and ding dongs that
doing blow off hookers and never just
as one does after defeating Iceland in the Junior Goodwill Games. Things got a little too decadent for Goldberg.
I could see
had to send him to fat camp.
Yeah.
But brings
to
mind.
Great question, by the way.
Yes.
Tony Perkins.
And brings to mind a discussion we were having with a Team Juggernaut member last week, James Townsend, in which all these little top lists were going around for.
James loves his lists.
He loves him some lists. He was probably making lists while he was eating Big Macs and washing his T-shirts on his 18-pack of abs.
Absolutely.
But James had a list that was favorite sports movies by sport.
Yeah.
And most of his list was wrong. I know the list is an opinion, but his were wrong. So let's give our own list. Favorite sports movie by sport, starting with football.
Varsity Blues. Varsity Blues is up
there. That's you and Pomp are all on the
was up there.
All in the Varsity Blues because of Tweeter.
Yes.
Tweeter's going to drink beer as well?
Yeah.
Tweeter drinks beer. I'm going Remember the Titans.
Okay.
Yeah. Going to basketball.
Oh, basketball. What was that movie with... I said Above the Rim on my list.
Uh-huh.
But what was the film with... I want to say Daniel Stern and Dan Aykroyd, maybe.
Whoa.
The Celtics, and they were. It was not really about basketball. It heavily involved basketball, but I believe there were some
around basketball.
Shitty criminals, or they were like the straight guys, but they had been abducted or something.
I don't know.
I'm gonna have to look it up.
A 30 for 30 that kind of goes to that effect, but it's Boston College, not the Celtics.
Yeah.
So you're going Above the Rim. I'm going with Blue Chips. Blue
Chips. Good. Yeah.
Nolte or Gary Busey, who really knows.
Same man.
Shaq as Neon Badeau. Definitely Shaq's best film role by a wide margin.
Second only to Kazam.
Okay. We got Penny Hardaway in there, Butch McRae.
Yeah.
We've got some white guy who was probably a real basketball player, but I don't know his name.
Yeah.
Fake young Larry Bird, we call him. That's a great
one. That was a good, White Men Can't Jump.
White Men Can't Jump is great. The Air up there, where Kevin Bacon goes to Africa.
Yeah, that was very good.
That is a good one.
How about Hoosiers?
Yeah, Hoosiers is good.
Hoosiers is one of those ones that's kind of a classic.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I already got my Remember the Titans in there, an actual good movie.
Yeah, actual good movie.
Yeah. But I know if it's, 3 p.m. on a Sunday afternoon, and maybe I had one or seven too many Moscow Mules on TV, and Blue Chips comes on.
Watching that.
Comes on Showtime or something, I am fucking watching it. Guaranteed. I would also watch any of these other movies we've listed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. For a while there, we were watching Mighty Ducks every day.
Yeah. So the clear answer, the next sport, hockey.
Mighty Ducks. James had a question mark.
Yeah. He didn't have an answer.
His wife had to chime in on Facebook and correct him. There may have been a crack in the marriage there after that. Yeah, Mighty Ducks 2.
Which number? You got to pick a number.
I'm going to say the first is so good. It's so good because it's so good because of how amazing the coach Gordon Bombay is in just breaking all the rules, yes. You know, and the fucking his mentor, his coach. When you watch it again, he was a terrible human being.
Yeah, coming back 20 years later as an adult and watching the original Mighty Ducks gives you a whole, and this is the case with a lot of Disney movies, I think, gives you a whole different perspective on what was really going on.
I mean, they're Pee-wee hockey, and he says to him when he sees the one flag that is yellow that's not a championship, he's just disgusted. Like, you clearly you're not like you probably earn fucking $35,000 a year. You're a hot like a Pee Wee hockey coach. Like you're like
this is a volunteer position.
Yeah, whatever this man does with his life, it's not great. You know it's not. But he holds that in such high regard. I could have done better. Like I wish they'd take that one down. Like you grown-ups. You're grown-ups now. It's Pee Wee hockey. It's not though. Some. It's the Mighty Ducks.
Yeah, in Minnesota, Pee Wee hockey is not just Pee Wee hockey.
Yeah.
So I'm going D2 as my favorite of the Mighty Ducks franchise. Slapshot, though, needs an honorable mention.
Slapshot was really good.
Excellent, excellent movie. Baseball.
I'm trying to remember which one I said. Major League. Major League's got to be up there, the Wild Thing. Definitely in the top. Major League 2 was also just fantastically good.
Rick Wild Thing Vaughn.
Yeah, you know, he actually played baseball.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I had a friend who was like a stand-in for him and was talking to him. This is before he went nuts. And he said, yeah, you know, he used to play baseball. He said he was trying to become a pro baseball player but instead pursued acting and insanity, I guess.
Yeah, well, he did a great job with both of those,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah,
he's done very well for himself. Baseball, Major League is great, is one of my favorites for sure. Yeah, it's hard to measure, like, if you see these movies as little kids, they're
so
probably
different.
Shitty movies, but you loved them when you were a little kid. Movies like Angels in the Outfield, Little Big League, Rookie of the Year.
Yeah.
Okay. Rosengardner with his broken arm.
Rookie of the Year. Really, that one really was a... That's just not even fucking close to possible. Just really, that... Disney should be in class action lawsuit for putting something like that out. There's no fucking way.
How many kids were running around intentionally breaking their arms?
Oh, my God.
There might have been a class action lawsuit. Someone Google that. Let us know in the comments. Class action lawsuit against the makers of the film Rookie of the Year, against Henry Rowan Gardner.
I mean, come on. This is not even fucking believable. Yeah, it's not.
Magical powers came along with that broken arm. Okay, now I guess there's boxing, there's soccer movies. I mean,
boxing, Rocky IV. That's obvious.
Same, Rocky IV.
Soccer movies. Soccer movies.
There's only one option that I can think. There's only one soccer movie I can think of. Besides, James's answer was Bend It Like Beckham. I hope you're watching this, James, and I hope you're ashamed of yourself. The Big Green is the answer. Another one of Disney just knocking it out of the park.
Yeah.
In from my age 7 to 11, somewhere
that
in that
range. That was a
range.
Fun movie.
That's
that
a good one.
Yeah.
It deals with race relations.
they really knocked it out of the park. Yeah, they really went hard on the emotions on that one.
Yeah. They're tackling a lot of things. And, of course, everyone's favorite golf movie is Happy Gilmore.
Yeah, so. There's really nothing much better than Happy Gilmore. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
So thank you, Yup Yup, It's Teddy, for getting us into the mind of Tony Perkis and
Tony
then segueing
genius
into the Mighty Ducks cast. Quick note on Tony Perkis. The exact same person as White Goodman? Ben Stiller only has three characters.
Three? I think he's got one and a half.
One and a half.
One and a half characters.
And Perkis and White Goodman, same.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Exact same
Absolutely.
Person. Then Zoolander is his own.
The
thing.
Other half.
And then every other character,
they're all the same.
From Meet the Parents to Along Came Polly to all of those.
I feel like when they write those scripts, it's like generic loser main character guy. And it's always just kind of like...
Well, let's get Stiller in here.
Yeah, like just Ben Stiller type guy.
Yeah.
And he just shows up and they're like, yeah, just do the thing you always do, you know, be kind of like how you always are.
Grind Sports Nutrition is the official supplement provider of Team Juggernaut, designed by Renaissance Periodization. These are no-nonsense supplements to fuel your hardest training. Use JUG10 at grindsupplements.com. All right, moving on. Tom Waits. I wonder if that's like a reference maybe. To Tom Waits.
Yeah. Possibly.
Well played. He may. This Tom Waits Mr. with Clever a Z here. Might be a more world's strongest hipster than me if it's actually a Tom Waits reference. And Vince PT kind of had the two of the same questions that were in regards to, you know, I see that my bench responds better to lower volume, higher intensity training while my squat does better with this. And then Vince was asking, is it okay to begin peaking one lift before the other lifts? And the answer to both of these is yes. It's okay to do this. It's probably necessary to do this. And some of the reasoning behind it is important to understand, because as so much of the stuff we do, we want to inform you with principles that can help you answer all of these questions for yourself in the future and understand why we're saying this stuff rather than just saying, well, they said, yeah, you can start this one earlier. But we want you to understand why. So as far as starting a peak earlier, that's commonly going to be necessary for the squat and the deadlift to begin peaking earlier than the bench press. That's going to be true for a number of reasons, some of which are the weights are heavier. You have to get to heavier weights with them, and it probably takes more workouts to increase to those weights, because you can't just jump, you know, 40 pounds or 50 pounds from workout to workout. So for you to get up to, let's say, 600 pounds in the squat or deadlift is going to take more workouts than it is to get to 350 pounds in the bench press.
So you would also say that the underlying principle in peaking, obviously overload has an impact, because you have to develop enough overload to have a peak, right, to have something to peak for. But SRA of each exercise is going to determine when that exercise is executed, when the exercise is actually done, and at what point it's stopped to allow for adaptation, right?
Yeah, and to the same effect with SRA, it's going to go into why you might need to start peaking something earlier, is that with these heavier weights and with the lifts that are more taxing, you have to put more time, they have longer SRA curves, you have to put more time in between the overloading sessions. So you might be able to bench hard at overloading parameters that fit with peaking twice a week or twice in 7 days, but maybe only twice in 8 days or 9 days, or for a really strong deadlifter once every, you know, or once every 10 to 14 days. So having the overloading sessions in there mixed with technique, lighter technical sessions to help technique stay sharp or even improve technique, because, again, SRA curve of technique is very short, while the neural SRA curve of something like a max deadlift is very long. You have to help those work together. So that could contribute to different timing. As far as the different phases go, you know, if you're in hypertrophy, maybe you have big, strong legs and not that big upper body, so you want to run two hypertrophy cycles for the bench compared to one for the squat or the deadlift. You know, hypertrophy training for the deadlift can be really, really challenging, make you so sore and take away from the other lifts, so maybe it doesn't need to be trained as long. So with all that being said, what I would try and avoid is getting two phases away. One thing is in peaking while another is in hypertrophy. That should generally be avoided, I think, because they're going to disrupt each other too much. I can't really see a scenario in which, in working towards a meet, someone would actually get into that.
Well, you'd just be, those would be conflicting.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially be conflicting, because the hypertrophy work would be so taxing that it would just, you know, I mean, there's decaying that fatigue simultaneously would be almost impossible.
Yeah.
Or it would just be very difficult. Yeah.
Cool. Our next question is from Peter Ball, and it is a question for Max. And Peter acknowledges that Bulgarian-style training, squatting every day, probably because he's watched our other videos and listened to this stuff, is not the optimal way to develop squatting strength. If you are hearing that and thinking, what the hell? Watch our video on a critique of squat every day, and we talk very in-depth, more so than we can in our time here, about that. Once you've done that, come back to this question, which is acknowledging that it's not the best thing for squatting. How do you feel about it for developing the classic lifts, the snatch and the clean and jerk? And for me to add something to this question too is, what do you think are the important, useful takeaways from Bulgarian training?
So, clearly it's worked. We don't need to argue whether or not it's been successful. We'll define Bulgarian training as basically attempting above 90% weights very frequently, near maximum and maximum weights on a very high frequency basis.
And with that,
what
Max said is, we're not denying that it is successful. We're also not denying that there are multiple systems across numerous sports that have produced great results. That alone does not mean that something is right. You know, I'm not much for ad hominem, straw man, all this shit. That, I guess, would be in the debate logic sense an appeal to authority, that just because they were strong, it is the best.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that they couldn't have been stronger. Have we made people stronger than that? No. Has anyone?
China, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say the Chinese are there. The Russians were there. I mean,
but for the people, you know, watching, listening, wherever you are, who are thinking that they know more about Bulgarian training and why it's good than Max does, you're wrong. You didn't do it under Abdeyev. Almost definitely, there's probably 50 people who probably aren't listening to this who trained under him, and you didn't train like that for over a decade. So pump your internet brakes. Other than thinking that you're an expert about this, and let's hear what the man has to say.
Defining it as very high frequency, maximum, near maximum intensity, very low volume, especially on limited exercise selection, snatch, you know, classic lifts, and very, very close variations, powers. And I would say probably some variations now, you know, there's clubs maybe use blocks and stuff like that, but very, very high specificity. The takeaways first would be that very, very high specificity and overload clearly work to develop, you know, high-level weightlifters. We know that because we know that from the scientific principles. It's obvious.
Yeah. Bulgarian system does the best job of those first two things. Checking off specificity, well, you only do the competitive exercises.
Yeah.
You really got specificity down well, and you definitely got overload down well, at least for certain qualities, if all you do is max out.
Right. While the question was, will it work for classic lifts? Yes and no. And again, a lot of it comes down to what is the goal, what are you trying to accomplish, and what is the actual situation for the athlete? It's impossible to say based on knowing nothing about the person asking the question, will it work for you to develop lifting prowess? It will work in certain periods, and it will work better if it's preceded by other phases of training that augment other qualities that are supportive to the results, to lifting a maximum snatch and clean and jerk, right? If it's used exclusively, if you're training like that exclusively for years, you will develop results. You'll develop a decent number of snatch and clean and jerk. You know, you'll be somewhat competitive and decently good. The possibility of getting injured goes up quite a bit. The possibility of becoming stagnant, not improving, not succeeding at competitions. There's a lot of things that are done very well. There's also a lot of things done in the system that basically negate the possibility of improving things that you're weak at, right? If your pull is terrible and you never do pulls to fix it, that's foolish because you have a means to fix the problem, but you're not using it. Again, like, you're going to see a trend in lifters that train like that looks similar, especially here, people that train like that, they generally kind of lack a second pull. They're a little bit more hit and miss. They're definitely more inconsistent in competitions. All those things kind of play to themselves to be, you might see results in the gym. You might see results in the actual numbers you lift here and there after 10 or 11 misses. In competition, when it actually comes down to it, are you a 4-for-6 guy every single meet, consistently smashing numbers and beating people? Or are you a 2-for-6 sometimes, or I've bombed out of 6 meets in a row, now I made a huge total, and oh, I'm great. That's the problem, is that the lack of predictability and the possibility for increased injury and possibility for just not developing all aspects of lifting. And then, you know, when you don't develop all things, or you don't have access to developing the things you need, it might not be a big deal the first year of lifting, but 6 years down the road, when you are, you know, you hurt your knee because your jerk technique is terrible, now you have to fix it. Now you're just as far back as if you had just spent more time earlier developing good technique, right? And it's not to say that, yeah, lifting heavy prevents that, but it does in the end, because you end up sacrificing everything to accomplish the workload.
And the neural fatigue becomes right. So high that it kind of disrupts the technical abilities.
Right.
Everyone knows it's hard to make technical adjustments at limit weights.
Right.
You've got to do it in those more moderate weights. And when Max is talking about that, it can be appropriate sometimes. It is peaking.
Right.
It is,
yeah.
But it is an endless peak. And the reason that we, you know, promote phasic structured training is because peaking is important, but you don't have to be peaked all the time because you're not competing all
right.
the time.
Right.
You know when you're going to compete. So we can increase the potential height of that peak with, you know, more general phases and strength-based phases. And when actual Bulgarian weightlifters under Abjayev were doing that, they negated the need for some of that because of drugs. And the same thing would hold true for a powerlifting programming that's very low volume but incredibly high intensity and really like only maxing out, even if it's less frequent. That lifter could still be very muscular and have the foundation for success if you take enough drugs.
Right.
So that covers up a lot of the problem.
You know, also, like, I think people maybe are – there's this idea maybe that breaking lifts down into different pieces and different components is somehow less effective at training the right skills and training things than the idea, like, well, if you just do snatch and clean jerk, you get really good at them. That's not always the case. It's really, really easy to do something slightly bad lots of times and get worse at it. That's obvious, right? It's also very possible to execute something in components and parts and develop more skill or better feel, better understanding of the skill because of doing that, in, you know, because of doing a snatch or clean jerk in a bunch of different small variations of it and developing better skill. It's more likely you'll be in that situation than in a situation of doing the same thing over and over again and developing great skill at it. If you get behind the bar when you're pulling on a snatch that's heavy, that's probably going to happen every single time you snatch until you do something that actually physically changes that and re-educate the skill, relearn the skill in your body. So it's just, it doesn't lend itself well to that. It's great for short times, peaking, et cetera, but as a foundation of the training, it just doesn't hold up all ends of the deal, really. It falls short in a lot of places.
Yeah, and it's all useful. You know,
yeah.
Maxing's useful, high volumes useful. The timing of it, strategic use of it is what makes the difference between a good program and a great program. Trifecta provides pre-cooked organic food delivered right to your door weekly to help fit with your Renaissance diet, fuel your hard training, improve your recovery, and make your life easier. Visit trifectanutrition.com/juggernaut. So those were some good questions.
Yeah.
The movie ones are obviously the most important. Let us know what your favorite sports movies are, unless you have the wrong answer and your favorite hockey movies. Not if it's Mighty Ducks 3, do you think there's someone whose favorite one is Mighty Ducks 3?
Oh, man. I would be disappointed.
They probably have too bad of taste to listen to such a fine podcast as this.
Okay, Miracle on Ice, Miracle. Okay, scenario. D2 team against United States team 1980 Olympics, Lake Placid. How big is the victory between Mighty Ducks versus USA? Mighty Ducks could have probably taken USSR and the USA at the same time.
Is this grown-up Mighty Ducks or 12-year-old Mighty Ducks?
It's 12-year-old Mighty Ducks. Of course it's 12-year-old Mighty Ducks. Gordon Bombay is coaching.
Oh, well.
Gordon Bombay.
Bombay, are they wearing USA jerseys or Ducks jerseys?
Ducks jerseys.
Well, that's a big, those are performance enhancing.
When the audience starts quack, 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 how intimidating is that going to be for Russia, Soviet Union?
But confusing, more so than anything. If a really good 30 for 30, if you haven't seen it, is called of Miracles and Men. And it's about the 1980 Miracle on Ice hockey game from the Soviet side.
Oh, interesting.
And it talks about the development of the sport of hockey in Russia. Because it wasn't a sport in Russia until like the mid or late 60s. And then by 74, 73, they were the best ever, winning every world championship. And they got some cool like general physical training video clips in it. And very interesting to hear them talk about developing the sport of hockey, having never seen it, that their coach had never coached hockey before. And he made an interesting point about it, that he actually tried to avoid watching a lot of hockey.
So he could
have his own concepts about it. So he said, how could we become better than the Canadian hockey team by trying to play Canadian hockey? Like, how could we surpass them by following on the same path that they're already down?
Very interesting.
Yeah. So
a lot
he
like
sort
if
of
just copied a Best Lifters program. And then you're stuck doing what they did.
Yeah.
Very intriguing.
So he sort of revolutionized hockey and taking it from the description they gave. And I don't know if this is true or not because I don't know shit about hockey. But from taking it about, he said that in Canadian hockey, the one person with the puck controlled the action of the other five players on his team. And he said in Russian hockey, the five players without the puck controlled the action of the one controlling the puck.
Ah,
so it was interesting.
That's very cool.
Of Miracles and Men, a very good 30 for 30. We can have a whole episode about just 30 for 30s, really.
Chad's 80% of the way to having a sports history degree.
I've seen all the 30 for 30s, so that whatever that does for me.
Yeah, that's 85% of it, I think.
Max, where can they find you?
You can find me on Instagram or Facebook, Max_Ada, or email me, Max@JTSStrength, for any questions about remote coaching or the Juggernaut online team, or if you're interested in Team Juggernaut.
Chad Wesley Smith, @ChadWesleySmith. Make sure you check out or subscribe to the Juggernaut YouTube channel. We're very proud of the content that we put up there. If you enjoyed the podcast, leave us a 5-star review. Write us something funny. We always enjoy seeing those. Learn more about Max and I, about get all caught up with all the past episodes at thejuglife.com. And if you're interested in online coaching, visit juggernautcoaching.com. Until next time.